You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Rosalind English. Hello, LawPod listeners. Today's subject concerns us all, whether we like it or not, death, and how we meet that inevitable moment. We all have our opinions about the manner of our dying, and recently these wildly differing views across society have been closely debated in Parliament, until finally we have the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill. It's passed both its first and second readings, and it's currently at the committee stage, and after the report stage, it'll receive a third reading in the Commons. If it passes these stages, it'll move on to the House of Lords for a similar process before it can become law. I have with me Barrister Alex Ruck-Keane KC of 39 Essex Court, who specialises in mental capacity law, mental health law and healthcare ethics. Alex represented Noel Conway in one of the challenges to the current prohibition on assisted dying, and he's been deeply involved in the evidence stage of the bill before Parliament. In this first episode on the subject, I'll be talking to Alex about the practical issues surrounding medically assisted dying, as they will arise when this bill becomes law. In the second episode following this one, we'll be joined by Dr. Mona Gupta in Montreal, a psychiatrist and leading expert on medical assistance in dying in Canada. She'll tell us about the Canadian experience of a system that is, in many ways, very different from the proposed legislation in this country. But first to Alex. Thank you very much, Alex, for making the time to come on to LawPod UK.
Pleasure. I'm going to have to start with an extremely boring disclaimer. I have to say that anything I say in the course of this discussion represents my own views only and not those of any organisation with which I'm affiliated or work with on an ongoing basis. I'm sorry, I just have to get that out of the way. But now all yours in terms of where we want to go discussion-wise.
Well, I completely understand your disclaimer because this is such a divisive, but anyway, deeply and profoundly felt debate that I can completely understand that you want to preserve your position as an individual. So actually, Alex, I would very much like you to give us a broad sketch of the bill's proposals and the safeguards as it currently stands.
Yes. So as you said in the intro, it's got significantly further than any other previous bill in this country, in England and Wales. As with other bills on this issue, it's a private member's bill. And that's a topic or an issue we may come back to over the course of this discussion. Introduced by Kim Leadbeater, MP. And it's a bill which is really framed around the idea of terminal illness. As the bill stands, you have to have, as it were, 6 months left to go. So you're not eligible unless it's reasonably expected you're going to die within 6 months. You have to have capacity, applying the Mental Capacity Act throughout, up to and including the final moment. And this is a bill which is very, very firmly predicated, and it'd be really interesting to hear Mona's views in relation to Canada, because it's very different to the Canadian position. It's absolutely predicated on the person themselves carrying out the final act. One of the areas which got discussed in the Public Bill Committee, and I suspect will come up again, is how far can the doctor go to provide assistance? Is it up to and including starting or setting up the syringe driver, which the patient or the person, rather, can activate by a blink response? You know, these are sort of things which are going to be very closely looked at as things move forward, if and when the bill passes. So terminal illness, capacity 18 plus. And the safeguards are essentially there's what's called a coordinating doctor who has to be satisfied you meet the various criteria, including that you've got capacity, you're not under any coercion or pressure, and your decision is informed and very much your own decision. And then there has to be an independent doctor. One of the changes made as this went through bill committee stage was there's a mandatory requirement to a referral to a psychiatrist if there's doubt about capacity. That previously had been discretionary. And then if you, as it were, pass the tests of the two doctors, that it then goes to a panel. One of the big changes people may have seen who've been following this, even if not that closely, one of the big changes has been it went in, or it was introduced that it was all cases were going to go to a high court judge. Now they go to a panel. There's quite a lot of debate, some quite heated on social media, about whether it's correct to identify this as judge plus. I think it's looking at the wording of the bill as it stands. At no point is anybody involved actually discharging a judicial function, but there will be a panel which has got a legally qualified member, a psychiatrist and a social worker. So there will be a multidisciplinary aspect. And if the panel approves, then the coordinating doctor can essentially go ahead and, after a suitable requisite period of time, put in place the arrangements to provide assistance. Normally one would expect to be the coordinating doctor person. Mechanics of how it could be someone different. The doctor has to provide assistance. The doctor has to remain with the person until they've died. It's not necessarily in the same room, but they have to be close to that person. One of the interesting, and whenever a lawyer like me says interesting, I always tell healthcare professionals they should panic. One of the interesting aspects of this is it's absolutely clear doctors are not allowed to do the final act to bring about the person's own death, but you might have a situation where complications have ensued and the doctor's required to be there. What are they allowed to do at that point? And there was a certain amount of debate about that in Bill Committee, and it left Bill Committee without it being entirely clear. So there are a series of safeguards. So it's a multidisciplinary panel, two doctors previously. And it's very, I think one thing just to emphasize, it's very different to quite a lot of other jurisdictions. I mean, no other jurisdiction other than Spain has any form of panel like this. It's also very firmly predicated purely on terminal illness. Many other jurisdictions are predicated on some aspect of suffering. And in some jurisdictions, it's suffering alone. Some jurisdictions, it's terminal illness plus suffering. Suffering just doesn't feature, interestingly, in the language of the bill. Although, of course, it features enormously in the discussions around it, because to some extent, this is put forward as a bill which is designed to alleviate the suffering of people who are terminal.
Can I ask just a very simple question? I'm sorry, it's probably been asked a thousand times and answered. Where does this take us when we have somebody who cannot, because of physical incapacity, lift the medication to their mouth? I mean, how is that dealt with? Or how do you predict it's going to be dealt with?
Well, it's not dealt with. I mean, it's flat out not dealt with in the bill. And I have to say, one of the things I find slightly challenging in some of the discussions around this is that this is quite often being put forward, or actually I should be careful, I'm not saying it's being put forward necessarily by Kim Leadbeater at all, but some of the media coverage and the social media coverage is advertising this as a bill which will stop people needing to go to Dignitas or clinics or Exit or another place in Switzerland, and highlighting the fact that there have been situations where people have gone and there have been situations where they have been investigated, no prosecution, but they've been investigated. And this has been put forward as the solution to make sure that doesn't happen. In fact, the overlap between the number of people or the cohort of people who might currently be going to Dignitas or Exit and the number of people who would necessarily benefit directly from this bill is very far from total. So to be clear, so that was rather a lawyerly way around of putting it. In fact, this bill benefits a small and important, but a relatively small contingent of people. It was very striking sitting next to Sir Nicholas Mostyn, former High Court judge, when we were giving evidence to the Bill Committee. Sir Nicholas Mostyn, who stood down as a High Court judge because he has Parkinson's, and I think he wanted to make sure that he had a period of time when he wasn't constrained by being a High Court judge to do all the brilliant things he does. Sir Nicholas Mostyn is actually very unlikely to be able to benefit from the bill as it stands. And it was rather sobering sitting next to him, having a discussion with the Bill Committee about what, for instance, the idea of discrimination means. Because one of the big issues and one of the issues around which there has been an awful lot of discussion and argument is the extent to which this bill as it stands would then be challenged or open to challenge in the courts if it's passed. Because obviously to date, and as you mentioned in the introduction, I was involved in Noel Conway's case, the courts up to and including the Supreme Court here have been absolutely clear. We will not get involved. It is for Parliament to decide whether to make assisted dying or assisted suicide legal. In my mind, there's a bit of a qualitative difference between we will not get involved at all versus it has been made legal for a certain cohort of people. Well, what's the reason for it not being available to others? And one of the points I was seeking to make to the Bill Committee, because I'm trying to be neutral, either for or against, just make sure this is good law, is to emphasise that people are undoubtedly going to bring challenges. And one of the things that the courts will no doubt take into account will be deciding whether Parliament had seriously thought through whether there was a justification for the differential treatment. So in other words, is there a reason why someone in the position of Sir Nicholas Mostyn is not eligible? And if there is, then the courts are very likely to go, we are really not going to get involved. If there is no good reason, one can easily imagine a situation where the courts go, we never took a decision. We left it to Parliament democratically to decide. What we're simply saying is, if you've set up a system, you have to set up a non-discriminatory one. Of course, it's really important that people understand that isn't the end of the story, because even if the Supreme Court said this is discriminatory, contrary to Article 8 and Article 14 of the European Convention on Human Rights, it doesn't automatically mean that the law changes. Because one of the big differences with Canada, of course, is that the Canadian regime was brought about by the Canadian Supreme Court saying the then ban in Canada was unlawful. And the Canadian courts have got the power to strike down legislation in a way that the UK Supreme Court, the UK courts don't. Well, one can imagine it suddenly feels very different where you've got the courts saying this discriminates against people who are cognitively unimpaired, physically unable to carry out the final act. And it's on one view, if the foundational idea of this is an idea of a respect for autonomy, it gets a little difficult, one might think, to start thinking through, well, what's the justification for saying that somebody who's physically unable to carry out the final act is denied the ability to benefit? Discuss.
I think it's very interesting that you mention Sir Nicholas Mostyn, because I, on this podcast, talked to, well, not on the podcast, but by way of preparing for one of our episodes on this, I talked to Sir Stephen Sedley, who, as you know, is in fairly advanced stages of Parkinson's. And it's the same issue, and we discussed that at length. But that brings me on to, I think this is obviously the next topic, which is the six-month time requirement, which Canada doesn't have, lots of countries don't have it. Do you foresee that being a possible ground for challenge to the legislation if it continues to have this requirement?
Well, I mean, it's important to identify that the bill has now left Bill Committee. It's heading towards report stage, and there are already amendments seeking to amend the bill as it stands to remove that six-month requirement, either altogether or to make a variation for it for people with neurodegenerative diseases. And I think no one seriously thinks that 6 months is something that one can identify with crystal clarity. It just isn't. It was actually rather ironic that as we were doing the Conway case, which was predicated on 6 months, the fast track benefit system was amended, because previously it had been based on you would only be eligible if you were within 6 months of death. And it was amended because it was so imprecise and it was causing real hardship. So it's quite odd having that mismatch. And we've again got that 6 months. No one really thinks is possible to identify with complete clarity. What it really is a marker. It's code for this is a bill which is designed for people who are much closer to the end of life. And again, an interesting question, the extent to which Parliament should be making law which is based on a sort of code, which everybody really knows, is actually a very imprecise code. And so whether courts would ultimately accept that there is a legitimate differential in treatment, or you know, the differential treatment is legitimate between people who in some way very much seem to be closer to the end of life, even though we know that people regularly outlive their prognosis quite significantly, but that kind of marker, the target group, the cohort group, and others who might be saying, well, look, if you make me wait that long, if you say it's that length, I'm not going to be able to benefit, either because I'll physically be incapable of carrying out the final act, or because I've got a neurodegenerative disease such as dementia, which means by the time X months rolls around, I will no longer have capacity to make the decision to carry out the final act. And again, this bill is very firmly targeted at contemporaneous capacity. It's really interesting to note, and I sort of feel duty bound to bring this up, we do have another piece of legislation out there. I mean, the Isle of Man has legalized, but another island around the periphery of the United Kingdom is on track to legalize, which is Jersey. And Jersey is being done after a slightly complicated set of events by way of a government bill. And just the contrast between how things have been set up here in terms of the debate, in terms of the support being given to parliamentarians and the engagement of civil servants and how it's been done in Jersey is really stark. And one of the interesting things about Jersey is, having thought about it in enormous detail, they think that they should have what's called a waiver of final consent. So you would have the ability to go, look, I know there will become a time when I no longer have capacity to make that decision, and I want you to still proceed. But that suddenly takes matters into a very different place, because you are no longer in a position where the person's carrying out the final act. It feels much more like euthanasia, as people tend to understand euthanasia. So in other words, the doctor doing the thing. I mean, I should say I'm duty bound. I teach law at the end of life at King's College London. And one of the things I always say to my students is, one of the ironies of this debate is that everybody is talking about euthanasia in a true sense, because euthanasia in Greek just means a good death. And so really what this is about is, part of what this is about, is an enormous debate about what our conception of good death is.
Which is precisely the title of Sir Stephen Sedley's seminar that we broadcast sections of, A Good Death. And indeed, we are talking about euthanasia. Just going back to the dignitas question, what is the position regarding informed consent with dignitas? Because if we're looking at aiming to stop people going to dignitas, is there a same issue with consent in Switzerland?
So dignitas, yes, you wouldn't be able to go to dignitas if you had advanced dementia and you were no longer able to. The precise way in which it's framed in Switzerland, some of the languages, it tracks across slightly oddly to some of our understanding in England and Wales, but essentially there is an informed consent idea. It's more the cohort of people who wouldn't be able to benefit other people who couldn't carry out the final act, because there's no bar on that happening in dignitas, if you see what I mean.
So, yes, okay. So going back to the possibility of a waiver, if it happens that we finally get that into the legal system, whether by amendment to the legislation, how do you envisage it would work? Would it be like, I think, as I understand it, in some states in Canada, such thing is called an advance request?
Effectively, it would be that, or I mean, the Netherlands have also got a similar idea. And one of the things which came out very starkly in one of the Dutch cases was, how far do you go to try and, as it were, accede or maintain or honour, or, you know, pick your own word, for that person's advance request? And the case where the Dutch doctor was prosecuted was where the person with dementia really did seem to be manifesting a fair degree of agitation. And the doctor took steps to overcome that agitation to effectively honour what the doctor perceived to be the person's true wishes. You start getting into some quite challenging ethical water quite quickly, which we already do to some extent have experience of navigating in the context of advanced decisions to refuse treatment. Because if one thinks about it, if you make a so-called ADRT, one of the issues which was always lurking in the Mental Capacity Act was, which is where advanced decisions have a statutory footing, what happens if you no longer have capacity to make decisions about medical treatment? So in principle, your prior refusal is live, but you do something inconsistent. Are you bound by that prior decision, or are there circumstances under which a doctor, it should frankly be unethical to say, we're not going to treat this person? It's not just we're imposing treatment on someone who appears to be non-resisting. This person's actively manifesting a desire. And there's an interesting case not that long ago where a judge said, the way the Mental Capacity Act is drafted allows you to take into account acts which are inconsistent, fundamentally inconsistent, even after a loss of capacity. And so if, and it's really important to emphasise, this is nowhere near the bill as it stands, and indeed I've not seen any amendments put forward which are suggesting this, but if we got into that terrain, and Jersey are navigating this because they're trying to legislate within a framework which looks very much like the Mental Capacity Act in England and Wales. So they're trying to navigate, how do you get it so that you're trying to honour the person's advance request, but have some proper mechanism to say there might be a circumstance under which this person's actually changed their mind, but they no longer have capacity of like our mental capacity at test. To my mind, it's as much an ethical question as it is a legal question.
Do you think the medical or perhaps the psychiatric profession are going to be rather scared, as it were, by the pressure to make these kind of decisions if that becomes a part of the law as we think it might?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fair to say, unlike some other jurisdictions, it doesn't appear that the psychiatric community in England and Wales are voting with their feet towards the door of assisted dying. There is a distinct degree of reservation being expressed by the Royal College of Psychiatrists, a lot of stuff being put forward in some considerable detail in both written and oral evidence to the Bill Committee about, for instance, how little people actually really get capacity right altogether. So before we even get into the outer reaches of waivers of consent, how people don't really necessarily understand capacity, the fact that the Mental Capacity Act wasn't designed to deal with a situation where we're talking about a decision to end one's own life. It was very much framed around medical treatment decisions. One of the fascinating things about Canada, and my colleague at King's, Gareth Owen, and I, together with a student called Mary O'Conyats, have been doing a lot of work looking at how the capacity test has been framed around the world. Canada, it's absolutely framed as a healthcare decision. Here, this is being framed as a decision to end one's own life, which on one view is much more honest, because it's not really a healthcare decision at all. It's a decision that, in service of my view of my value of my life, I wish to end it. It's a very, very stark decision, but the MCA, Mental Capacity Act, was never designed to answer that question. And one of the things that the Royal College of Psychiatrists has been pointing out is we're going to need a lot of help understanding what the relevant information is. How do we think about it?
We've covered the various detailed possible problems and possible legal challenges that may emerge as a result of this bill becoming an act in its present form. But do we understand how it's going to function from where we are now?
So, again, from a position of what I now sort of vaguely describe to myself as armed neutrality, in the sense of I'm neutral, but if this is going to happen, I'd like it to be good law. I think it's vitally important it's good law. It's quite striking that we still don't know precisely how this is going to work. At one stage, it was really unclear as to whether this was actually going to be a bill which was purely about legalisation. So in other words, simply getting out of the way of a willing doctor and a wanting patient.
So how in practice is this act going to work? Is it clear from where we stand now, Alex?
So the short answer is no. We do have more clarity than we did when the bill went into the Public Bill Committee. At that point, it really wasn't clear whether it could be just a pure legalisation bill. So in other words, simply getting out of the way of a willing doctor and a wanting person. It's now clear that the Secretary of State is going to have to make regulations to provide or make arrangements to ensure voluntary assisted dying is available. But what's not clear is where or who is going to be carrying that out. Is it going to be, as it were, on the NHS, or is it going to be commissioned by private practitioners? We just don't have that level of detail. And I have to say, from a perspective of somebody who's neutral on whether this passes or not, it does seem challenging at a minimum to say we could have something with this lack of clarity. I mean, it's such an important aspect of what's going to happen, not least because if this is going to pass, and if it's going to happen, it's got to happen in a way which is equitable and accessible by everybody. Because otherwise, all that's happened is you've managed to move a group of people out of paying money to go to Dignitas to a situation where they're having to jump through an awful lot of hoops to go through something in England and Wales. And it hasn't actually been a piece of legislation which is designed to do what Kim Leadbeater is clearly intending, which is to provide the ability for people who satisfy all the various criteria, no matter their economic background, no matter wherever they are in England and Wales, to be able to access assistance with dying.
And just a final question before we go on to the Canadian experience. Why do you think this has happened? Is it because this rather unsatisfactory nature of the bill is a small victory, it's a crack in the door, etc., etc., but it hasn't quite got us there?
Well, I suppose that slightly presupposes that one is wanting to get there, if you see what I mean. I should say I set my students at King's this term at Law at the End of Life the question, is assisted dying progressive? And I'm very much looking forward to seeing their answers. And I think it's really interesting to unpick, and we will be unpicking in oral histories for years to come, the extent to which this is a Trojan horse. This is genuinely a piece of legislation which really is designed only for this very limited cohort of people. We talked earlier about how limited the cohort of people it was. And I think also, as you say, this was a bill produced under quite unusual circumstances. There's a really interesting interview with Dame Elizabeth Gardiner, who drafted it, former lead parliamentary counsel, had, I think, 14 days to do it. By comparison, Jersey, the instructions to parliamentary draftsmen there or draftspeople there are 200 pages long, and they think it's going to take 18 months to 2 years to draft. So I think there are a whole cocktail of circumstances, and it's important to flag that there have been a significant number of amendments made to the bill, mostly advanced by Kim Leadbeater since it hit the Public Bill Committee, and no doubt more will be made as it passes its way through. But the contrast between a situation where you go, a governmental initiative that we want to have this, we want to make it work, and a situation where a private member is seeking to introduce such a radical change is really quite stark.